Good morning. My name is William Castle. I represent the State of Wisconsin Labor and Industry Review Commission. This case has its origin in a collective bargaining dispute between a 37-member multi-employer bargaining association of sheet metal and air conditioning contractors on the one hand, and on the other hand, the contractors' employees who are members of Local 18 of the Sheet Metal Workers International. Each contractor member of the association authorized the association to be its exclusive agent for all matters related to collective bargaining. When the association and Local 18 failed to reach accord on a new collective bargaining agreement, Local 18 responded by initially striking only one of the association members, construction, supply, and erection.
Council, could you make sure to speak up? I'm having a little difficulty hearing.
You might raise the podium. There's a button at your left.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, thank you.
This whipsaw strike began on June 7th, 1996. As the court knows, a whipsaw strike is a labor union tactic designed to exert extreme economic pressure on individual members of a multi-employer bargaining association by striking them one at a time. The goal of the whipsaw strike is to put the fear of economic devastation into the minds of all employer members of the association, since all members have good reason to fear that they could be the next target of the whipsaw strike. In its certification of this case to the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals summarized the Commission's argument concerning the dilemma facing association members who are under the threat of a whipsaw strike. And I quote from that Court of Appeals certification, page 6. Quote, under the trial court's interpretation of section 10804 sub 10, an employer member of the association has no protection from coercive strike tactics such as a whipsaw strike. Under the trial court's interpretation, an employer member can either wait until it is the target of a selective strike, or it can lock out its employees and subsidize the employees' loss of work with unemployment compensation. Excuse me. In effect, the employer would be financing a strike against itself. Unquote. Now, the legally recognized defense which members of a multi-employer bargaining association have against the whipsaw strike is the defensive lockout, whereby all of the members of the association respond by locking out all the members of the local union involved. Accordingly, on June 11, 1996, the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association initiated a defensive lockout affecting the members of Local 18. The defensive lockout and the whipsaw strike predictably ended shortly thereafter on June 14, 1996, when a new collective bargaining agreement was tentatively approved by both sides. But the Local 18 members who had been defensively locked out for the partial period of 1 week at issue claimed unemployment benefits for that week. Appellate Labor and Industry Review Commission denied their unemployment claims pursuant to the provisions of Section 10804 sub 10 sub D. That statute renders claimants ineligible for unemployment benefits if they are involved in a labor dispute which is directly subsequent to a strike by their labor union. Following the statutory language, as well as the purpose and intent of the statute, the Commission found that the defensive lockout in this case was such a labor dispute. By asking the court to uphold their position in this case, the respondents effectively ask the court to make three errors. First, they ask the court to ignore the purpose of Section 10804 sub 10, which is to keep the unemployment insurance system neutral in labor disputes. Second, they ask the court to ignore the language of the statute. And third, they ask the court to undermine the use of multi-employer bargaining, which has been recognized by the courts as a benefit to both management and labor. As the Wisconsin Supreme Court stated in Marathon Electric Manufacturing v. Industrial Commission, that's 269 WIS 394, the law of unemployment insurance in Wisconsin takes a hands-off approach to labor disputes and stays neutral. Section 108.04 sub 10 ensures neutrality by providing that participants in a labor dispute remain ineligible for unemployment benefits during the active progress of such a dispute.
Now, Mr. Castle, how many employers are there in this association for collective bargaining purposes?
37.
How many?
37.
Okay. And this may not be in the record. Did all 37 lock out, or
there was
that, not allow the employees to work? I want to keep it neutral.
There was a very brief testimony on that point to the effect that there were a couple, I think two, possibly three, who did not participate, did not lock out, and there's no...
But the others did?
The others all did.
So about 34?
Correct.
Over 30 did lock out?
That's correct. And there was no testimony as to why those two or three did not lock out as they were required to do under their... membership contract with the association.
They have a contract so they're obliged to lock out?
With the association, that's correct. When they sign on with the association, they agree to participate or to allow the association to lead them in all collective bargaining dispute matters.
It's not a violation of concerted activity?
Which would be?
I don't know. They all agree to do something?
Oh, yes, I believe it was on their part, but again, there was no testimony as to what happened.
The point being that because there was no strike at Ellingsworth, but it's a member of an association, I know the local union or maybe local 18 makes the point that it takes more than just being a member of this association. So what, other than a contractual obligation, if you had two, or would it make any difference if you had 37 and 18 did what Ellingsworth did and 16 didn't? Would that make any difference?
Would it make any difference to our case?
To your case?
No, I believe not.
Because of the contract?
That's correct, and because of the context in which the lockout took place, it was a defensive lockout in reaction to the whipsaw strike.
Well, I think it might make a difference because you're stressing the purpose of this statute. And if you find that most of the, or many of the employers don't lock out, then they don't think it's such a big deal for the purpose of the statute.
Well, the ones who did lock out would be the ones who we would say would be subject to the statute. I'm not, that would be a hypothetical as far as ones who didn't if that came to us. I hesitate to say what the commission would do.
Did the administrative law judge make any findings of fact with respect to the, seems to me, one of the fundamental issues in this case, and that is whether the this was a lockout by the employer designed to be to create a pressure on the union to settle?
No, he made no such finding, and in fact the commission made the finding that it was the opposite, that the pressure was initiated by the well, in effect, that's not entirely true. The pressure was initiated by the union. The defensive lockout is its own form of pressure in response to the initial pressure by the union. That's why we talked about this. I was going to talk about this balancing of the forces here.
Well, this is quid pro quo. In other words, they selected one of the so-called 37 members. They being the local 18, had a strike, and then the response was the so-called defensive lockout. The response of the association was, all right, we won't, this is our response to what you did by selecting the CS and E to go against them.
That's correct.
Oh, do we know that? I mean, let's assume a situation in which we've got a hidden tape recorder in the room of the employers, and they know that one of their members of association is being struck, and they say, look, the best way that we can act to force the union into bargaining is for all of us to lock out all members of these employers. So we've got an absolute undisputed fact that the lockout is designed to create pressure on the union. Are they entitled to unemployment compensation under those facts?
Well, the fact would be disputed by respondents, but the commission drew the factual inference that there was this purpose. That was the purpose of the defensive lockout, to respond.
Well, wasn't that the purpose of the association in requiring its people to lock out?
Yes.
That's the whole purpose. You don't need any tape. You've got it right in their association rules.
That's what I would agree with, and the case law shows that the courts have recognized this sort of circumstance throughout a long legal history of whipsaw strikes and defensive lockouts. They balance each other up.
The union hits or strikes what they view as the most likely to succumb.
That's correct. For whatever reason they choose.
And the employers here combined to and had an agreement that one for all and all for one. So if the union picked off one, they would pick off all of the union employees.
But yes, their stance basically is, let's make this a fair fight. They've thrown the punch. We're going to punch back with a defensive lockout.
The statute we're talking about talks about of the employer. So we have to make the jump that the employer here is basically the association, right? Because...
Yes, and Section 108.02, sub 13, sub A defines employer in the unemployment compensation statutes and includes association as one of those definitions.
Counsel? But first of all, what's that site that you just gave?
Section 108.02, sub 13, sub A.
Crucial to your argument, following up from Justice Wilcox, is the definition. This is a case of statutory construction, right? So that's what we're focused on. I mean, there are questions of facts, of course. There are questions of policy. We're looking at, initially, the words of the statute. And in looking at the statute, it seems to me, based on your briefs and arguments, that crucial to your argument is, as Justice Wilcox just indicated, that the definition of employer is association. Is that fundamental to your argument?
I'm not so sure it's fundamental because
well,
we are talking.
Look at sub D then.
Yes.
I mean, that's what I took from your brief, that it was fundamental. But let me see if I can.
Well, in the sense I'm saying, and not necessarily the associate, in the sense that we're only talking about the one employer here and its liability for unemployment benefits. It is fundamental.
Let me focus on the statute. Let's see if I can focus my question. I'm looking at sub D. The language, as I understand, that is the essence of this argument with regard to sub D, the language I think that Lurks says is ambiguous, is, which is not directly subsequent to a strike or other job action of a labor union or group of employees of the employer. I mean, that's the focus of whether or not that is excluded from the lockout exception. That's what I understood your brief. Am I wrong?
No, that's correct.
And so your position is, when I read of the employer, it has to mean that the association is the employer. Is that correct?
Yes, in effect, that would be correct.
And you just gave the cite to Chapter 108 in furtherance of that argument that says the association can be an employer. And I assume that's why you gave that cite.
Yes.
I have the legislative history. And the legislative history, and I'm looking now, I guess, at an assembly bill, 3965, page 3965 in the legislative history, which indicates that allied employers, language existed after this phrase of the employer. And initially they had, right after that, inserted right after of the employer, or an allied employer. Then they defined allied employer. They defined it as allied employer means an employer which is jointly participating in collective bargaining with one or more other employers. This legislative history seems to me, since they then struck out allied employer and struck out the definition of allied employer, which is the association that we have here today, that it suggests that an allied employer is not what is meant by of the employer. An association is not what is meant of the employer. Can you respond to that?
Well, that's the inference you're drawing from that change in the legislative draft. I have no idea, frankly, what prompted the drafter to take that out. It could have been considered superfluous, in my opinion, because the language of the statute today talks about of employees of the employer. When we're talking about an employer, we're talking about an employer. An employer is defined in the statute as including an association. It certainly includes, it would seem common sense-wise, to include the Illingworth Corporation in this circumstance. They were the employer of the employees involved. I don't know how else you would interpret that statute, frankly. As I've said in my brief, when the statute refers to labor union of employees of the employer, that term labor union is in there, and there's been no response from respondents as to why it's in there if it doesn't refer to actions by a labor union. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Castle. We have 2 moments to rebuttal. Mr. Wyman, representing the Illingsworth Culture.
Good morning. My name is Jerry Wiedemann, and I represent Illingsworth. I'll take my prepared remarks and set them aside and address a couple of questions. First, and the most essential, I think, here is the concept of the bargaining unit. If you have a freestanding industrial factory and the employees of the production and maintenance operations unionize, they frequently do so in a unit that combines them into one bargaining unit. In the construction industry, because of the multiplicity of employers and the movement of employees between employers, the law has favored, and in fact, history has favored it as well. The employers associate together to deal with the union. They often are smaller employers associated with larger employers. And that way they develop a balance with the large trade unions like Local 18, which is statewide. Is the association the employer? No. The employer is each contract. What's important here is the fact of association makes these people one employer, one establishment for the purposes of the statute.
Could you repeat that? I missed that.
I'm sorry?
Could you repeat that?
Yes.
Your hand or something hit the back.
All right. I'll keep them still. The essential fact here, and I think it's the rule of the A.J. Sweet case, as explained in Sullivan, is that the fact of the association of these multi-employers into one association makes them the employer and makes them one establishment for the purposes of this 108 sub 10.
So it sounds to me like you're saying that the association is the employer the terms of the statute.
I'm not saying that the association is the employer. It is
Could you repeat that? I don't quite get it. I heard you say that it isn't, and then when you explained it, it sounded to me like you're saying that it is.
Right,
the same problem with Justice Kavanaugh.
Right.
You've got to help us.
Perhaps if we distinguish between the employer as sheet metal, SMACA, Inc., that's not the employer. If we look at the employer as the associated contractors, yes, that's the employer for this purpose.
Only for this purpose, not for wage claims, not for workers' comp, but just for this purpose, for the lockout purpose. Is that your point?
I hadn't considered its availability in other areas, so I won't.
You don't want it available in other areas.
Perhaps not.
No.
So for this purpose, though, you view it as the employer.
Yes. And if we look at the statute, it's almost designed for this situation. The 83 amendments were addressing a particular situation. I, too, have looked at the legislative history, and I wish I knew more about what sparked this amendment. But it certainly seems that there must have been a situation in which the legislature wanted to distinguish between an offensive lockout. An offensive lockout being one in which the employer, before job action by the union, locks out its employees in aid of the employer's own objectives in bargaining. And a defensive strike, a lockout, being one in which the employer reacts to the job action or strike of the union. The legislature clearly created a distinction between offensive and defensive lockouts in that amendment. Why? I contend that it's precisely because of this type of situation, where through bargaining being a long string of strategic and tactical moves, the culmination of bargaining may be a strike, or it may be an offensive lockout. But I think the legislature was saying, if it's a defensive lockout, then the employers should not be put in the position of financing what in fact is the action against them.
And that gets back to what I was asking your co-counsel. It sounds to me like whether a lockout is a defensive lockout is a question of fact. Am I correct?
I would contend it is one of timing. If it comes before...
Well, I'm distinguishing it as a question of law. It requires a determination that, in fact, the employers were responding to the employees in a manner that is allowable by law rather than is not allowable.
Yes.
How do we determine that? I mean, is it a swearing contest? The employer saying, gee, we only did this because of those bad employees, and the employee saying, gee, we have no intention of doing anything against those employers. They're really just doing this in order to coerce us into settlement. How do we determine that?
I think the burden would be on the labor organization at that point. If the labor organization selectively strikes, and our association reacts with a defensive lockout, I would contend that creates, because of the sequence of events, I would contend that creates a presumption that this is a defensive lockout, the purpose of which is to react to the pressure exerted by the union. So let them tell us it wasn't.
In order to be a defensive lockout, it has to be one which is directly subsequent to a strike or other job action of a labor union or group of employees of the employer. Is that correct?
Yes.
And again, instrumental to your definition of the employer, you're talking about the association there. Am I wrong? I just need to understand this.
I am talking about the associated contractors are the employer.
Okay.
And that, I think, is what A.J. Sweet tells us.
and you're not defining of the employer in sub D, which I just read, as being Illingsworth.
No.
Yes. It's ambiguous. Ask, are you defining Illingsworth as the employer in D?
Yes.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
Are you defining Illingsworth as the employer in D?
Illingsworth is one of the associated employers, but it is not the employer for the purposes of sub D.
The employer is all of the contractors.
The associated contractors.
For D.
Then how do you... do you have any explanation at all, in looking at the legislative history, why the very definition of association that you ascribe to the word employer here was struck out? Any sense? Is there anything in the legislative history that could point you to why that happened?
No, it would be surmise based on experience.
Okay, what's your surmise based on...
The word allied employer has significance in for federal labor law purposes that would have led the drafters in a whole different direction than I think they wanted to go. And therefore, when someone took a look at it and the concept of allied employers, they said, no, we don't want to go there. Because allied employers could be far broader than simple associated employers as they are here.
So for the definition of employer, we have to just look at the general definitional section of Chapter 108, which includes association?
That certainly is the excellent starting point, and I think Sweet and Sullivan then tell us that once associated, that's what the association is, those associated contractors, and then for purposes of 108.10 sub whatever, they become the employer for that purpose.
Do they pay their... UC taxes through the association or individually?
Individually.
Does that make any difference?
No.
Yeah. And the word association is used in that definition means, can mean, not this kind of association, but... or can mean this association. Does this association have any employees of its own?
Yes, it does.
Okay, so if that would cover their own employees, could be read that way.
It could be. I want to make, once again, the essential point here that I think is key to all of this. There's no question that this job action came directly subsequent to this lockout came directly subsequent to a job action or a strike of the union. There's no factual dispute there. The essential issue is, who's the employer, what's the establishment? Now, in order to make their argument fit, the petitioners have had to say to you, CS&E is just one, is a separate unit, like it had nothing to do with the association at all. And like there was an issue about... My time is up. Thank you.
You may finish the sentence, Counsel, if you can remember now what you said.
All right. Be much like Mr. Reagan. I've forgotten it already. Thank you very much.
I have one follow-up question. Yes. With regard to the statutory definition of 108.0213A, a quick read of it suggests to me that an association can be an employer, as well as a corporation, a number of other things, guardian of the estate of a person, legal representative of a deceased person, partnership or partnerships, all of those can be employers. Does that answer the question of what was meant by the term of the employer in the statute before us? So all of those things can be employers in it. Can you respond to that? I mean, I really need help with this. I mean, it seems to me Illingsworth can be an employer, a deceased guardian of the estate of a person can be an employer, a partnership or partnerships consisting of the same partners can be an employer, an association can be an employer, all sorts of employers. What's the of the employer as used in 108.04.10 sub D?
Certainly, certainly any one of those entities could be an employer, and I would agree that the day that Illingworth withdrew from the association and took back the agency it had given the association to conduct all of its collective bargaining affairs for it, the day it did that, it becomes a freestanding employer. But while we're there, while we've given the association everything, all of our power to deal with this union, we are associated employers, associated contractors, and one employer for this purpose.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Robbins, representing.
Matthew Robbins and Jill Hartley on behalf of the employees of Illingworth. Let me start with one of the questions you've asked here. The question is not whether an association can be an employer. Many entities can be employers. The question is, who is the employer of these employees? To that, the position taken by opposing counsel is contrary to the rest of the statute. 108.212 defines an employee as someone providing services for an employing unit. These employees weren't providing services for an association. They were providing services for Illingworth. 108.0214M, an employing unit is the person who employs. These people were employed by Illingworth. 108.0215, employment is serviced by an individual for pay. The association wasn't paying these employees. Illingworth was paying these employees. So the concept of employer of these employees suggested here is contrary to the statute, the definitions in the statute, which existed at the time of the lockout amendment.
Let me ask you, if this is a statute is neutral, can you imagine that we have an association here and the union selectively picks one of the members? What recourse then would an association have? Here, their recourse was so-called defensive lockout, but basically what it means is that that they would not be able to, would not be effective in order to have any lockout if they had to pay unemployment compensation. In other words, what if it's a neutral situation and the union had picked one of the members and this is said not to be a response to that, and I think you feel that it was not a response to that particular strike? Is that what you're saying? That this action, this of Illingworth or others,
they did it. Illingworth testified that they did it at the direction of the association. But remember, Your Honor, a so-called offensive lockout is also legal. And it's also one of those things provided under federal labor law. Employers and employees have the right to use various tactics. Now, when the legislature amended the law to have a lockout exception to labor disputes and permit people to receive unemployment compensation benefits, they're undermining an employer's use of that legal tool, a lockout, as to attain its goals in negotiations. So to that extent, yes, the lockout amendment itself isn't perfectly neutral. That was a legislative decision. And that's critical here. Now, we also think that at the time the statute was amended, there was a long-standing definition of establishment by this court, and the legislature is presumed to be aware of that when they used the term establishment. For counsel to suggest that actually the legislature meant something else when they used establishment in 1983 is without support. The two employers here have no connection except that they've assigned their bargaining rights to a nonprofit organization called SMACNA to serve as their agent in bargaining. They have no common ownership. They did not. There's no evidence they had common employees. They're not even in the same business One is a traditional heating, ventilating, and air conditioning contractor. The other produces and installs siding and decking. So under the standard for an establishment that was in effect at the time of this amendment was passed, clearly they were not one establishment. In the Sweet case cited by counsel, the employers was pre-lockout. The employers locked out in support of their position in the bargaining. Here what happened. At the end of the bargaining, there was one issue left. What was going to be the pay rate for addendum workers? The sole testimony concerning why the strike occurred at CS&E was because they were the largest employer of production of addendum workers, the form of lower wage production worker. It wouldn't make sense for the union to strike Illingworth over this issue. Illingworth didn't have any addendum workers, and that's part of the record.
Is it part of the, what you said previous to that, is it part of the record that all issues have been negotiated successfully?
Yes.
Except for the addendum workers?
That's correct. That was the issue that the strike occurred about.
And we'll find that in the record.
Yes. That'll be the testimony of Ted Kaczynski, the president of the union. Now, what counsel want to say is make a judgment that some tactics that unions, or maybe in the next case an employer use that are lawful under federal labor law, are bad or unfair and give an unfair advantage, and therefore we shouldn't allow the employees to receive unemployment compensation. That's just a pure value judgment by the commission. The commission has no special expertise in collective bargaining, and it doesn't even have authority to make judgments about tactics that employers and unions use in labor disputes. That's completely preempted by federal labor law.
Counsel, I think you argue that the statute is clear and unambiguous, don't you?
Yes.
Okay, let's say for argument purposes, I think it's ambiguous. So our job is to discern the legislative intent.
Yes.
We look to purpose, and I see three purposes that are set out. They were set out in the Lurk decision. And the first purpose of the statute is to fairly compensate employees. The second is to be neutral. And the third is not to have employers unnecessarily pay for a strike against themselves. So I kind of think, well, that's a wash. A says pay, C says don't pay, and B says be neutral. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm correct. I'm saying that's the way I see it. Correct me. So then I get to the purpose. Beyond the purpose, I get to the legislative history. Tell me how you think the legislative history supports your interpretation of the statute, or tell me how any other extrinsic aids of interpretation assist you and hopefully assist us in trying to discern what the legislature intended.
Okay. First, the original bill did not have the expression of the employer in it. That was added by amendment. You have also cited reference to the legislative history and reference to allied employer. Those both are pieces of legislative history that lead to the conclusion that we were talking about a single employer. Second, when you talk about the employer of the employees, which is what we're talking about under Section 10A, you look at the other definitions cited in the statute that existed at the time of the amendment, which clearly show that employer was the person who pays the employee, the person for whom the employee works, not some general group. It would make no more sense to say if the employer's assign their bargaining rights to a law firm rather than an association, that somehow now the law firm under the Unemployment Compensation Statute was the employer. So all of those, I think, are legislative history which support legislative history and structure of the statute which support the unions, the interpretation we argue here. Finally, they've argued that establishment means the associated employers, but that's just inconsistent with the well-settled definition of establishment in the court's decisions that existed at the time of the amendment. So all those things support the conclusion that when they talked about employer of the employer, they were talking about the employer who employs the employee seeking benefits. The position taken by Work here presents some immense practical problems also, one alluded to by Justice Babich. First, it presumes a motive on the part of the union. Now, the union president testified that the reason they struck CS&E was because they had the employees whose wage rate were the subject of the dispute. A union may engage in a selective strike for many reasons, not necessarily because it's looking for this whipsaw effect. For example, it may think it would be a bad public relations move to shut down the entire construction industry in the middle of the summer. It may not be able to get employees of other employers to go on strike, particularly as here where the issue didn't affect most of the other employees in the union. The union may have mixed motives. The reason that there was a strike call for a particular employer may be because it was voted on at a union meeting and it was passed 100-80 not to strike everybody but to strike this employer. What are we going to do then? Engage in an interrogation of each person who voted at the union meeting as to was your motive the whipsaw effect or was it you didn't like this employer? It's just simply impractical. So that's why the commission just wants to assume that what the motive of the union is. Now, there's another problem with the commission's interpretation.
Was there any testimony with regard to the union or members of the union or anyone testifying that they intended to strike others or they did not intend to strike others? Any testimony offered?
There's no testimony that they... either way, and they never did. Now, if you say that really of the employer means somehow employers who are going to be affected, so it's a defensive matter, other employers are going to be, why stop at the line of, well, the ones who had assigned their bargaining rights? Remember, in this case, there are many independent contractors who signed the identical agreement. They could be as affected as Illingworth by the results of bargaining. Are we then going to say that these employers are then, because they have a vital interest, can they lock out in support of the employer who struck? But if we can do that, what about industries like the auto industry where there is no multi-employer bargaining? But there's pattern bargaining. Every 3 years, the UAW picks one of the employers and says, we're going to set the pattern with you. Does that mean if they strike General Motors and Ford locks out, even though Ford and General Motors clearly are not are separate bargaining units, separate contracts, then now Ford can say, hey, this is a defensive lockout.
Because you have this contractual association. Ford and GM wouldn't have that, but here, because of the size, the type of industry, you have this relationship in a contract which, according to opposing counsel, indicated that there was an obligation to take some action.
The contract whereby the association agrees to represent these people contains provisions like that. Of course, in the real world, some employers locked out, some employers didn't. There was no testimony, by the way, that it was 30 versus... We know that there were some employers who locked out, some didn't. Some locked out some of their employees and not other of their employees, depending upon the job site. So it's not inevitable that a selective strike of an association leads to all employers, each employer makes its own decision in the real world.
Would the result be any different in your mind if Billingsworth had had many addendum workers?
I don't think so, because of the structure of Section D in the phrase of the employer. We think what the way the Section D is written, it was meant to cover this following situation. And a union may engage in a partial strike or strike of an employer. A group of employees may engage in a partial strike. A department walks out. There's a wildcat strike, even sometimes unorganized worker strike. So that's a employer lockout subsequent to a labor union, a job action by a labor union or group of employees of the employer. The second, of course, the second one is subsequent to the termination of a job action. So, for example, if the union ceased its strike at CSNE and CSNE said, "Oh, wait a minute, we're not going to go back until, we're not going to take you back until we settle the strike," or the a group of employees wildcat, or there's a partial strike, and they stop it, the employer may say, "No, until we get some things resolved, we're not." So I think the structure of Section D really would prevent, even if Billingsworth had addendum workers. As a matter of fact, it didn't here.
Well, what if... Boy, this is not an area of law I know a whole lot about. But let me use as an example a hotel, a big hotel, that's got, I would assume, got many different kinds of bargaining units. There's Teamsters and there's restaurant workers, et cetera. Is that, can I use that as an example?
Sure.
You understand that. And the one bargaining unit, let's say the restaurant workers, go on strike and against the hotel, and let's say the Teamsters, so the hotel then locks out all employees. What's your position with respect to unemployment compensation? Do the employees... Are they entitled to unemployment comp?
No, because it would be at the establishment where they are employed.
Okay. So an employer does have the right to lock out, under this statute, to lock out all of its employees, even if all of its employees aren't striking them.
That's right. For example, the term lockout wasn't used, but there are cases, a company like Ladish in Milwaukee, it has 8 unions. One of the unions strikes. At some point, the employer says, "I'm closing down. I'm not going to continue to operate at all until the strike with Union A."
Good. That's a much better example than mine.
And what the courts have held and the commission is they're unemployed as a result of the labor dispute at their establishment.
so they're not entitled to unemployment compensation.
That's correct, in those circumstances.
Counsel, in the legislative history, it looks like Senator Jowd, this is his bill, and that Governor Earl went to Superior to sign it. And he signed two bills, this bill and a bill that made it, which increased the penalty for shooting a moose. As a response, there was a moose near Superior that was shot, and so he signed the bill about that. But this article in the legislative history says the governor made a special trip to Superior for bill signing because of years of protest against lockouts, which union officials say Superior area employers had used unfairly to deny their jobless workers access to unemployment checks. Is there any import from, if you've read this article about Earl going to Superior and why the bill measure was expected to make it easier for locked out workers to collect an estimated annually from the fund which employers are required to subsidize. Is there anything from that, or is that just an interesting piece of history that has no import to what we're talking about today?
I don't think there's, you can infer the legislative intent from that reference to the signing of the bill in Superior. I'm sure that there were lockouts in Superior, as there were in other parts of the state, and that may have motivated Senator Jowd. But, you know, we have to look at, in looking at legislative history, we can't look at the motivations of individual legislators. We have to look at the actual objective history.
How about the moose?
How about the moose?
You know, they have problems up there. There was deer lately on the runway. Did you see
that? In Milwaukee, we have Canadian geese. That's the problem.
All right.
Could I ask, sir, there was reference to 108.02.13, the definition section of employer. It begins right in the beginning. Employer means any government unit, any person, an association. Other than that reference to association, is there anything else in the definition, lengthy definition of employer, that would be helpful to the other side, or is that what they have to rely on, that one little tiny reference?
I know of no other reference to association in the unemployment compensation statute. I think it's pretty clear that it's just listing a number of different entities that could have an employee, just like the association here happens to have several people who work for it doing clerical functions or other functions. There are no other references in the statute to association.
So if they struck, can the association lock out others?
Pardon me?
So if the employees of this association struck?
There are no... Oh, the employees of... The staff of the association
exactly.
Struck, yes.
That's what you're saying that refers to?
That just refers to... That just says an association can be an employer covered by the unemployment compensation statute.
And that, would that authorize Illingsworth then to lock out its employees?
No, I mean, if you lock them out, they'd be eligible for unemployment compensation benefits.
Even though they're part of that association?
Even though they...
And why wouldn't Illingsworth be a 137th employer?
I don't think even as a legal matter that's correct. I think what happened is the association is incorporated and people contract to have their bargaining done by the association.
Okay, so the shareholders, you're saying, of the association. Illingsworth is a shareholder. Maybe it's a non-member.
I'm not sure of the exact corporate structure. I do know that it's incorporated.
You see where my mind is going in terms of going back and forth in terms of if you start making Illingsworth equal to the association and the association equal to Illingsworth. Illingsworth, it has other ramifications, but go ahead.
In this case, in order to come to its decision, the commission wants to emphasize that an employer, some employers who lock out in response to a strike of another employer are acting lawfully under federal labor law. An employer who locks out just to enforce its will without any complicating factors about it is also acting lawfully under federal labor law. That's not the issue here. And you can't decide this case by using pejorative terms like whipsaw or break the association or leave the members defenseless. You have to do it based on the structure of our unemployment compensation statute. The employing unit of these employees was Illingworth. The term establishment was well settled at the time that the amendment was put in for lockout exemptions. The term of the employer was added to the lockout exemption during the course of the legislative process. All these things lead clearly to the conclusion that the amendment, the legislative intent was, it was referring to a lockout in response to a job action of the particular employer, not of some other employers who may have common interests. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robbins. Were there any other questions? No. Mr. Castle?
Thank you. First, I'd like to respond to the assertion that there was only, that the only issue left in this collective bargaining dispute was the addendum workers issue. There is no testimony to that effect. There is testimony on page 25 of the transcript to the effect that that was, at first the business manager responds, yes, that was one of the reasons when asked if the addendum workers was the reason they struck construction supply and erection. And then upon further questioning by counsel, he says that it was the reason that you struck construction supply. Yes, it was. Okay, just so the record is clear, addendum workers are not. They're all local union 18 members. But enough, the testimony was that was the reason they chose construction supply and erection, but not, there was no testimony to the effect that all the other issues of the negotiations were resolved. Even if they were, I don't think that changes the outcome of the case, but that is something that was brought up. The fact that the council made the argument that the commission has no, that this matter should not be decided based upon federal labor law. We agree. The federal labor law is the background of this dispute that defines these terms, which he described as pejorative. I don't think they're pejorative. They're simply terms describing what happens. You call it a defensive lockout, you call it an offensive lockout, you call it whatever, strike. That's the term you use because it defines a certain course of action. Those terms are in the federal law, but the commission, as our arguments have been made in the brief, relies upon the language of the statute, in particular sub 10 sub D, which talks about a labor dispute which is not directly subsequent to a strike or other job action of a labor union or group of employees of the employer. Respondent has still not given us a reason for the words labor union in that statute. We're talking about an action, a job action by a labor union. If we're not talking about something like we're talking about here today, we don't know what that means. There's never been an explanation of that from respondents.
That's not really the problem area, though.
Pardon?
That's not the problem area of statutory interpretation in this case. The problem area is the meaning of the phrase of the employer.
That's another issue that I'm not entirely sure where the justices are going with that phrase of the employer. We certainly we certainly know that Illingworth is the employer of these employees and that the there was a defensive lockout at that employer's establishment, that employer's place of business. And also that Illingworth was a member of the association. Again, I'm not entirely sure what...
But there was no job action at that employer.
Oh, there was a job action at Illingworth, yes. The job, the commission's argument is that the job action at Illingworth was the defensive lockout. A lockout is a labor dispute. It is defined in, that's mentioned in A.J. Sweet, that a, it's long been held that a lockout does include a labor dispute. So we did have a labor dispute at Illingworth once they initiated the defensive lockout. And normally a lockout, once you initiate a lockout, you have to pay unemployment benefits. But the commission's argument is that you don't have a statutory lockout in this case because sub 10 sub D takes it out of that context. It says that it defines lockout and says lockout does not include this instance where you have a job action directly subsequent to an action by a labor union. So you have a defensive lockout, a labor dispute occurring at Illingworth, but you do not have a statutory lockout which allows the payment of unemployment benefits.
Right. There's a defensive lockout exception to the lockout exemption to this statute.
Correct.
Right. And the question here is the scope of that defensive lockout exception to the general lockout exemption.
Sure.
Yeah. And on that,
the original error note, the employees who were striking were at which company?
The employees originally struck CS&E.
Okay. And Illingworth then locked out its employees.
That's correct.
Got it. That's the employee. Chief. Thank you. Yes. Mrs.
Crossley. In subsection D, this subsection, lockout means the barring of one or more employees from their employment in an establishment by an employer. Who is that employer?
Well, I guess that's what we've been talking about all day here. I find it difficult to see too much significance in distinguishing between Illingworth and the association as the employer. They're both employers in one sense. Illingworth is its own individual entity as an employer. It's also connected for purposes of collective bargaining to this association, which is an employer.
What I'm trying to get at, isn't that employer Illingworth and the subsequent employer, arguably, the association?
It could be.
Well, then which employer is SM, whatever its name is, CSNE, in that statute?
Well, I'm not sure why it has to be one or the other, frankly, but I guess if I have to choose, I would take the last one. Say that's the employer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Castle. Thank you, Mr. Lieberman. And thank you, Mr. Robbins. That concludes our hearing.